Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland, made with heart and passion. For more information, visit emmyusa.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Okay, it is Monday. It is 12 o'clock. Actually, a little after 12, but that doesn't matter. And this is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. Happy fall, everybody. I know it's not really fall yet, but almost. The weather has certainly changed here in New York City and definitely taken a turn for the better after what appeared to be months of crushing heat. Anyway, today we are kicking off my fall season. We're going to be talking about water quality issues and agriculture around the United States. It's a problem that is affecting more places than you probably realize. And that includes, of course, the tragedy that is unfolding before us in Florida and on Florida's coastlines, where there is an historic and epic bloom of not only red tide, but also something that is sometimes known as blue-green algae, otherwise known as cyanobacteria. We're going to be talking to two people today about this. The first one is on the line with me right now. His name is John Hollick. He is the mayor, I want you to take note of that, the mayor of Venice, Florida. He spent, I think he told me, 28 years in the financial industry before he went for his third run at, he has been elected three times, actually. Let me make that clear. He is obviously a very popular guy in Venice, Florida, and he is enjoying his third term, which began in 2016. So, Mr. Mayor, thank you for joining me on the program today. I so appreciate your time out of your, I'm no doubt, sort of slightly frantic office at the moment. Why don't you set...
My pleasure.
Thank you so much. Why don't you set the scene for us vis-a-vis the Karenia, am I saying that right? Karenia or Karenia brevis and the cyanobacteria that are plaguing the coastline of your area.
Yeah, why don't we just call it K. brevis because that'll make it a lot easier.
It does.
K. brevis is a natural occurring algae. It seems to reside on the bottom of the Gulf, and best projections are it's anywhere from 10 to 40 miles out from shore, and every once in a while it pops its ugly little head up to the surface, and this time we just happened to get a relatively large bloom that popped up several months ago and worked its way inshore. And it's really when it comes closer to shore that it causes the problem. Out in the Gulf, it tends to just be an alga and doesn't cause much of a problem. As it gets closer to shore, the wave action breaks it apart and it releases its toxins. And that's when we end up with fish kills and difficulty breathing and a myriad of different problems that pop up from the K. brevis.
Uh-huh. And then to compound that, you have blue-green algae as well, right?
Yeah, totally different than the blue-green. The K. brevis is a saltwater algae, and it does not do well in fresh water at all. It'll die off. The blue-green algae is a freshwater algae that dies off once it gets out into saltwater. So two totally different organisms. The blue-green, there's a lot of evidence that runoff from various nitrogen and phosphate type of fertilizers really cause that bloom to prosper. It actually gets very, very thick, and will the fish kill from the blue-green algae is actually more of a suffocation type of a kill than the K. brevis, which is a gaseous toxin that does the fish kill.
And
so two different animals.
Right, but both in play at the same time in this case. Has that happened before?
Yes, it has. It seems that the blue-green algae is a something that has gotten much, much worse over the near term than the K. brevis. The K. brevis, I recall very distinctly the 2004-5-6 bloom lasted 18 months, and it was just as bad as this. We just didn't have the coverage at that time like we do from social media. We know a lot more about what's happening right when it's happening today than we did even 15 years ago. But I do recall that bloom. I lived in the same house I live in now, and it was difficulty breathing, a lot of dead fish. Yeah. I think we did a better job of cleaning, picking up from the dead fish 14 years ago, 15 years ago than we did now.
Really? How do you account for that?
Cuts in budgets. You know, people will cut our entire beach area for the entire part of Sarasota County is maintained by the county, not by the cities. I was looking at their guidelines for what they do for cleanup of dead fish, and they were changed in 2013 because I was trying to go back in my memory. And back in the 2004, 5, and 6 range, I'm still not done collecting the data on it, but it seems to me they were out almost daily picking up the dead fish, which when that happens, yes, you end up with the effect of the algae bloom, but you don't end up with the stench of the dying fish. This time, because of the change in the way they picked it up, we ended up with both the toxic bloom plus the dead fish smell. And quite honestly, we didn't know there was a change until after we were saying, how come the fish aren't being picked up?
Yeah. And the reason is because there have been budget cuts to whatever services are available to perform that duty, correct?
That's what I assume. I haven't had a chance to talk with the county yet.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times you can pick these things up from bits and pieces of emails and bits and pieces of policy changes that you didn't even know were there.
Mm.
And once you start putting them on your desk and spreading them out, you say, wait a minute, here's a change. There's something here that's that isn't like it was 15 years ago.
Right, right. Who was the governor of Florida 15 years ago? What's his name? What was his name? Christ?
I don't know if Christ was then, or, you know, I'd have to look. But the governors, right up until Rick Scott, were very supportive of clean water.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until this time around where we had a substantial budget cut for the water districts. We've had legislation introduced where the state has usurped the power of local governments from writing any ordinances to control or fertilizers.
Ooh.
And I believe it was 2011 when that came on.
Wow.
If you didn't have an ordinance on the books by 2011, you couldn't put one on. And you can't change the one that you've got.
No kidding.
So, you know, a lot of times we can write an ordinance and it sounds good, it starts out good, but then we find out that it needs some tweaking to make it even better. And right now we have that problem where we can't even tweak it to make it better.
Incredible. Tell me, how much has this algae bloom affected tourism in your area, and what has been the financial impact on your area?
I don't have the financial figures. I can only say they're substantial.
Yeah.
How has it affected it? Well, people that had rental properties, either rental homes or coming to hotels, they just canceled.
Yeah.
People didn't come downtown to shop.
Mm-hmm.
We were currently undergoing a major beautification project in our downtown area, which already burdened our business district because the streets are ripped up. Okay. But we had good signage and good parking, and people were still coming downtown. Many of the businesses said it's only about a 5% loss, which is not a bad loss for having a complete beautification project. Mm-hmm. But as soon as the red tide hit, it went from a 5% loss to 60 to 70%.
Whoa.
So it, and the ripple effect is the thing that really, really hurts. I sit on the board of directors for the South County United Way, and requests for United Way services are up by over 40% since the red tide hit. People unable to pay their utility bills, people unable to pay their rent because the jobs that they had, many of the jobs in this area are service-oriented.
Yep.
They're not out there. They're not able to work. Nobody's going to the restaurant, so you don't need waiters and waitresses and cooks.
Mm-hmm.
Waiters and waitresses and cooks don't go to work. They don't have the money to pay for their rent and utilities. So it's a ripple effect I'm afraid that we'll be feeling for quite a few months, even though right now red tide is not bad here.
Uh-huh. So how many fish have actually, like in your area, you talked about how it still smells of rotting fish and they're not really cleaning it up. Well, can you give us sort of a gross estimate of the pounds, the number of pounds or the number of fish that are washing up? And are you part of that area that's seeing like even a lot of turtles and I don't know what else would be washing up there, but, you know, turtles, other aquatic life.
And you used exactly the right word. It is gross. We
yeah, I bet.
Have a little over 3 miles of beach in Venice.
Mm-hmm.
And in that 3 miles of beach, I don't have the figure for just that. I have it for Sarasota County.
That's good enough.
Over 160 tons of dead fish.
Whoa.
There are quite a few turtles. I don't have the figure on the turtles. Last I read, it was younger turtles, not the ones that were laying eggs, and not the babies that were hatched. The babies, when they hatch, still have a yolk sac on, and their instinct is to get in the water and swim out to the seaweed, and the seaweed patch is beyond where the red tide is.
Uh-huh.
So they don't eat anything, so they don't die. The turtles, manatees, porpoises. We've had some killer whales.
Yeah.
Pygmy killer whales. They're apparently the cause of their death is from eating fish that were about to die, which of course would be swimming slower. So the fish were loaded with toxins, which in turn went into the bodies of the mammals and the turtles.
Yeah. Wow. It's just heartbreaking to hear this. So let's talk a little bit about sort of why this is happening. I mean, you have a lot of agricultural activity around Sarasota County, right? There are a lot of sugar plantations. You have some livestock happening there. Okay. What are those agricultural connections that you think might be having an impact?
Sugar is not here. We mm-hmm. have livestock and we have other types of farms of fruits and vegetables that we enjoy in the wintertime, some of those come from this area.
Uh-huh.
So it's that type of agriculture. And I was looking at a chart that says that only about 6%, 6 to 7% of the nitrogen and phosphate that's used on land is used on residential land. The rest, we use almost as much on golf courses as we use on residential property.
Wow, right.
So that, between those two, that's about 12%. And then there's other types of fertilizers that are used. But the vast majority of it, about 70%, is for agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
So we have runoff from those types of land and from The other runoff that produces a high amount of nitrogen would be from waste of things like cattle and the leaching into waters from the cattle droppings. So our cattle farms are contributors as well.
So what can you guys, I mean, as the mayor of your city, what can the county do, what is the county doing, I should say? You mentioned earlier that it's hard to write an ordinance now about how much fertilizer can be used and so forth. So what are your options in terms of trying to regulate some of these issues to help head off a similar situation in the coming years?
Well, the city's relatively small in relation to the county. We're 16 square miles. As a percentage of the county, it's like the head of a pin.
Okay.
we have 21,000 people, and the county is close to 300,000. So we have 3 miles of beach, and the beach line for the entire county is probably 25, almost 30 miles.
Uh-huh.
So what we can do is the best job we can do to educate our people, to let them know that there are things they can do. Like, I have voluntarily myself stopped using fertilizers on my home lawn.
That's a good start.
It doesn't seem to make any difference. We didn't do it. We've lived here for 25 years, 27 years. Mm-hmm. Out of those 27 years, we've actually only fertilized our lawn for 2 years, and it really didn't seem to make a difference, so I'm going to stop it again. We make our own weed killer. We don't use Roundup, which is another big cause. We use a weed killer that's made out of vinegar, Epsom salt, and Dawn dish detergent.
Oh, wow. That sounds good.
And it works great.
Yeah.
You know, sure. And it doesn't hurt the environment.
Right, right.
So there are things that can be done, but it's things that you have to educate people on.
Yeah.
And I think that's going to be the biggest thing we can do. To try to put an ordinance out that regulates the use of fertilizer, that's one thing. But the difficult part is enforcing it.
I'll say.
And unless we were to hire double or triple the size of our police department to be able to enforce it, people can just go to the store and buy the fertilizer and put it on anyway. But if they know there's an alternative, if they know they can still do something and not harm the environment, many people will use that alternative instead of using the harmful one.
Yeah, I agree.
So I think that education is really the key.
So do you have a budget for that?
We're making one.
How do you feel the state has responded, not just to the crisis in Venice, but the whole of, you know, I think it's about, altogether I've read that it's about 120 miles of coastline that has had, taken a tremendous hit from both the K. brevis and the cyanobacteria.
About the best thing that the state has done is declared a state of emergency, which makes low or no interest loans available to small businesses. But that's really a small part of it. It's not just the businesses that are hurting. It's the people that work in the businesses that are hurting. The state of emergency on a state level is not like FEMA coming in and reimbursing or putting people up or doing anything like that. So everything that's being done for the people is being done through nonprofit organizations like the United Way or like a number of Salvation Army really steps up to the plate during periods of like this. So those are the ones that are really helping the individuals. The state, I have difficulty when there people at the state level can't even say there's climate change.
Yes.
It just makes no sense when people you have to remove that from your vocabulary when you're trying to talk with someone. Something's wrong there.
Something's very wrong. Something's nasty in the woodshed, as the great novel Cold Comfort Farm.
If we don't correct it, there won't even be a woodshed.
Yeah, exactly. So do you feel like, so you're saying essentially, let me back up here and say that the reason that I contacted you, as we discussed when I first read this letter, was a letter you wrote to Governor Rick Scott asking for, you know, more financial aid in terms of just research on how to get rid of these recurring, you know, problems, specifically with the blue-green algae, which is definitely something that can be controlled much more readily than the, K. brevis. So did you get a satisfactory response from the governor's office to that letter that you wrote?
I really haven't gotten any response, and I didn't think that I would, because it's not a topic that really wants to get to the top of anybody's list right now in Tallahassee. But it's amazing as you start looking into things like this. Moat Marine is doing some phenomenal work in their research. University of Florida does phenomenal research. And if we can get these different organizations to work together and get what they're missing is consistent funding. It doesn't do any good. Or I shouldn't say it doesn't do any good. It does little good to get funding for 1 year, and then the red tide is gone. It's in its rest period, and all of a sudden, we're not going to fund it anymore. So the research stops dead in its tracks, and we wait until everybody's suffering again, and then reignite the research. It's like starting all over again.
Yeah, that's just crazy. That is just crazy. Well, Mayor, we have to leave it at that. But thank you so much for joining me today. And I wish you guys the best in securing the funding you need and also the help you need in cleaning up the beaches. And, I'll keep checking back in with you. We can do another show about this at a future date and see how it's shaking out for you. Thanks so much for joining me today. I appreciate
it. Okay, Katie, you're welcome. And thank you.
You betcha. And let's take a quick sponsor drop and we'll be right back with Dr. Larry Brand from the University of Miami. Stay tuned.
Today's program was brought to you by Emmy Cheese, specialty cheese from Switzerland made with heart and passion. Since the early 1900s, Emmy has been a passionate supporter of farmers, cheesemakers, and family tradition. They believe in sustainable agriculture and respect for the people, land, and animals that make their business possible. Remaining dedicated to tradition, they strive to lead the industry in innovation, ensuring they bring you only the highest quality, best-tasting cheese from Switzerland. Emmy is best known for importing more than 80% of the Swiss Gruyere into the United States, but that's not to overshadow their other specialty cheeses, including Kaltbach Cave Age cheeses, Der Scharfe Max, Appenzeller, Tête de Moine, and traditional Emmentaler. For more information, visit emmyusa.com. You so bad, I'm losing my mind. You so bad, hurts.
You're listening to What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer. We're broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And this is the Heritage Radio Network, in case you didn't know that since you've tuned into a podcast. I'm guessing that you probably do. But anyway, today we have been talking about some major water quality issues and specifically the giant algae bloom that has crippled tourism for Florida's eastern coast, all along Sarasota County. It encompasses about 120 miles, I've read. And after we just spoke with the mayor of a small city in that area to talk about sort of the economic impacts on his constituency. And now we're going to talk to Professor Larry Brand, who is in the Department of Marine Biology and Ecology at the Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Miami. Dr. Brand, thank you for joining me on the show.
Sure, thank you.
So just give us a quick, I know that the phenomenon of this, the K. brevis coupled with the cyanobacteria has covered about, is it, are they both sort of coming together and covering 120 miles of coastline, or is it really primarily the K. brevis that is the culprit here?
Well, no, the it's primarily K. brevis, the so-called Florida red tide, which is along the coastline there. The cyanobacteria, also known as blue-green algae, they're a freshwater algae.
Right.
And so they're primarily in Lake Okeechobee, and then that water is coming down the Coosatchee River. So it's feeding into the estuary there. So, you know, it is sort of meeting up there at the coastline, and so all the nutrients associated with the Coosatchee River and Lake Okeechobee are sort of feeding those nutrients into the red tide to make it worse.
Right. Can you give us a little? I know that the whole wetlands and part of the Everglades were taken over sort of back in the 60s, and you know the landscape has changed kind of radically over the last 50 years. Can you give us a little bit of a background on how the watersheds have been altered in those past decades?
Sure. I mean, let me give you the consequences first, and then I'll explain what happened. In general, wetlands are very good at sucking up nutrients. They're like a nutrient sponge.
Right.
So the water's coming out of, you know, traditional wetlands are very low in nutrients. When you dry those out or you drain them and turn them into, say, agricultural land, now all of a sudden they start releasing huge amounts of nutrients. There's a huge nutrient source as opposed to a sink.
Oh.
So that's the basic story of South Florida. We've taken huge amounts of wetlands and destroyed them, dried them out. We drained the Everglades and so on, and turned them in largely into agricultural land. So we've gone from a nutrient sink into a nutrient source.
Yeah.
So if you start in the north, just south of Orlando begins our watershed, the Kissimmee River Basin. It's a whole string of lakes there, and there's a small meandering river, the Kissimmee River, surrounded by large wetlands.
Uh-huh.
And that meandered all the way down into Lake Okeechobee. And around the 60s is when much of that was drained. And in doing so, the Army Corps of Engineers channelized the Kissimmee River, so made it half as long. It used to be a long meandering river. Now it's a sort of channelized straight chute down to Lake Okeechobee. And of course, those wetlands are drained, turned into agriculture, mostly cattle ranches, dairy farms, I think it's probably some citrus and so on. So now you're shooting all those nutrients down into Lake Okeechobee. Similarly, in the south, the northern third of the Everglades were drained as well and turned into agricultural land. It's called Everglades Agricultural Area, which like perhaps 90% of it is sugarcane.
Uh-huh.
And to keep that dry, they actually reverse the flow of water in South Florida. They actually pump the water. It's called back pumping. They pump the water back up north. There's a natural watershed. It's go from the Kissimmee River into Lake Okeechobee, down through the Everglades, down into Florida Bay.
Right.
But they actually reverse the flow of water using giant pumps to keep that sugarcane acreage dry, back pump it into the lake. And the other part of the story now is initially there was essentially none of this water going to the East Coast or West Coast. There was no St. Lucie Canal to the east. That was dug so you connect the St. Lucie Canal to the St. Lucie River and the southern Indian River Lagoon.
Uh-huh.
So now a lot of this nutrient-rich water dumped into the lake is now going down the St. Lucie Canal into the St. Lucie Estuary and into southern Indian River Lagoon. And you might remember a couple of years ago we had those famous guacamole algae pictures from the blooms of blue-green algae or cyanobacteria there in the St. Lucie Estuary. Similarly, the Coosatch River was not initially connected to Lake Okeechobee. The headwaters of Coosatch River actually was Lake Hicchipee, just to the west of the lake.
Mm-hmm.
But again, to accommodate all this back-pumped water from the sugarcane fields, it was connected up.
Mm-hmm.
So that now they can dump the water from Lake Okeechobee down the Coosatch River, down in the estuary and on out to the west coast.
Right. So that's why there's cyanobacteria on both sides of Florida at this point.
Exactly.
So
the blooms this year, they started, you know, in the lake itself. First of all, because it's extremely nutrient rich now from all the agricultural runoff into the lake. And then when that lake gets too high, the Army Corps of Engineers has no choice but to release that water. Otherwise, the dike, that earthen dike, will burst.
Oh, my God.
And when they release that water, you're releasing all those nutrients as well as those blooms of cyanobacteria down those rivers to the coastline.
So you sent me a couple of really interesting papers, which I read with you know, great attention. I'm going to truncate them, you know, for the audience and because we don't have too much time. But you examined data from 1954 to 63 and then again from 1994 to 2002 on the density, the duration, and the seasonality of red algae. Tell us what you found in those in that paper. What were the findings?
Okay, well, first of all, I should point out that there's good reason to believe that the Florida red tide did occur on the West Coast, even as, you know, as far back at least as 500 years ago.
Yes,
based
yeah.
on,
that is important to say, yeah.
So it is a natural phenomenon, but by comparing what it looked like in the 1950s with 50 years later, what I found is the red tide now, on average, I mean, I say average because it's really important to note, it fluctuates up and down from year to year. There's a lot of variability here that we don't completely understand. But on average, it's like 15 times more abundant now than it was 50 years ago.
Do you think that has something to do with climate change? I'm sorry to interrupt you, but just curious. Is that because of the warming waters?
Not really, not likely. I mean, to get 15 times more algae, you need 15 times more nutrients. And I can't think of any natural sources of nutrients that have increased 15-fold. In the last 50 years. Now, what has increased dramatically over the last 50 years, of course, is us.
Right.
Dramatic increase in the number of people living along the Southwest coast, as long as a huge increase in agriculture in the interior. And so it's quite clear. I mean, you can look at the nutrient records and so on. There's a huge increase in nutrients in these waters now, and that I'm quite convinced that, you know, the red tide is much worse today because primarily of what we call anthropocentric nutrients, you know, from human sources.
Right.
A large part of that is agriculture. The huge change in our watershed, going from wetlands that are naturally a nutrient sink to going to agricultural land, which is naturally a nutrient source.
Right. Interesting. And then the other paper that I looked at was your paper on cyanobacteria that stated that it could have serious health implications, such as increased incidence of neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's or ALS or Parkinson's. Has there been a concurrent study that shows a higher incidence of those diseases in the intervening years since you published this paper, which was in 2010?
Not here in South Florida. I mean, first of all, I'm not a medical researcher. I'm an ecologist. I study more of the causes of these blooms.
Right.
So in that case, what I'm citing is other people's research.
Yeah.
But we do know, I mean, what actually the discovery of this neurotoxin BMEA was made in Guam after World War II, when there was like a 100-fold increase in the incidence of these neurodegenerative diseases among the local Chamorro people of Guam. Subsequently, people have looked for this elsewhere, and yes, what you find, statistically speaking, in like New England and France and Sweden and so on, people who live near lakes that have, you know, where there's blooms of these cyanobacteria, statistically have a higher chance of coming down with these neurodegenerative diseases.
Wow, and that's because of this bacteria BMAA.
It's a neurotoxin.
A neurotoxin.
It's produced by the cyanobacteria.
Wow. Doctor,
so I have documented
that's terrifying.
That this BMA toxin is, in fact, in seafood here in South Florida. I've shown this in high concentrations in Florida Bay, Southern Biscayne Bay, in the fishing Coosatchie River, and in brains of dolphins over in Indian River Lagoon. So,
wow.
These blooms are producing this neurotoxin that can lead to neurodegenerative diseases, yes.
And Dr. Brand, these algae blooms are prevalent throughout the United States. I'm going to go off on a tangent here. I warned you. But, you know, like Toledo, Ohio has suffered these giant algae blooms many summers running in the past decade. So they clearly are also at risk for exposure to the same neurotoxin. Am I right?
Correct. Yes, that's true.
And your research is really focused just on Florida, I guess. But I'm just curious if you have run across studies that are showing the same kind of levels of neurotoxins in other cities and waterways in the United States that haven't necessarily gotten the same kind of attention.
Not too many studies like I have done, but in terms of, I mean, I do know like up in Lake Erie, I mean, there have been, people have done some studies, and again, statistically, people have a higher chance of coming down with these neurodegenerative diseases if they're living, you know, near the near Lake Erie and things like that. So, I mean, from that point of view, it certainly looks, you know, like it's of concern. In terms of actually documented the BMA in the seafood, I don't think there's been any other studies here in the United States. I know the Swedes have done a study up in the Baltic, and they saw the same type of pattern that I saw.
Wow, that's incredible. So when you wrote these reports, where were they submitted? Did they just go into scientific journals, or did...
Correct. These are peer-reviewed scientific journals. It's actually it's actually a scientific journal called Harmful Algae. I mean, this is becoming such a big problem now on a global basis. There's a whole journal dedicated to what we call harmful algal blooms.
Yeah. Wow. That's, I'm sorry to sound like Pollyanna here, but gee whiz. I don't think anybody really... It's kind of good that this is getting so much attention from the press. I mean, even the media is picking up, you know, I mean, I am no less of a, you know, newspaper reader than anybody else. And it's certainly been, I've seen more reporting on this particular incidence of algae bloom, which, you know, as you said, the K. brevis is a naturally occurring phenomenon. You know, but there's been more reporting about the blue-green algae as well, and I don't think people really have taken in the fact that it, A, has this connection to neurodegenerative disease, and B, that it is so very widespread around the world, not just in the United States, but anywhere where we have access.
The BMA story has only developed fairly recently. I mean, I said that it was initially discovered after World War II. Well, it's a long history here, but basically it really didn't... get a whole lot of attention and understanding until in the past decade or so, and it's just now starting to sort of seep out from the scientific literature to the general public, I guess you could say.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, and also, I mean, we're getting a lot more, I mean, initially it was fairly controversial, but in the last few years we're getting more and more evidence that this really is true. I mean, you know, in the early stages of the research, there's a lot of, you know, unknowns, a lot of questions, and thrashing around, figuring out what's going on. But now we have a pretty good understanding of what's going on. We know why it's causing these neurodegenerative diseases. You can, you know, induce this in lab animals and so on.
Mm-hmm. And does the CDC have any role to play in this? Or, I mean, are they reading this or some other sort of, you know, organizations, USDA aware? I mean, this does sound like kind of a major public health problem, what with the growth of the cyanobacteria problem.
I'm sure some of the individual researchers are aware of this, but I think at the level of, you know, administrations, I think they're pretty much ignoring it for now, as far as I can tell. We're not getting any funding from these federal agencies for this type of research.
And what about state funding? How does the governor...
No.
Because the governor doesn't actually believe in climate change. But cyanobacteria is not necessarily a result of climate change. It's a result of agricultural runoff.
Yeah, I would argue, I mean, these blooms, I get the question all the time. I would argue the primary cause of all these blooms, and I mean, these blooms are increasing all around the world. This is not a local thing only. It's a global problem. Now, this is also, we're having to feed 7.5 billion people now. So there's a lot of fertilizer runoff from agricultural land, and that 7.5 people generate a lot of sewage.
Right.
Now, does climate change have an effect? I think it has a small effect in that these two groups are talking about, the cyanobacteria, they're the most primitive of all the algae. They've been around for 3.5 billion years, and they like warm temperatures more so than the other algae. So as you increase the temperature, that gives them a competitive edge over other types of algae.
Interesting.
And to some extent, that's also true for the red tide. It's a... something called the dinoflagellate, and dinoflagellates are a primitive group, which also tend to like warmer waters. So one could argue that, you know, if you have a lot of nutrients, you could have other species of algae, but if you have higher temperatures, you could give a competitive edge to these blue-green algae or cyanobacteria and the dinoflagellate. It's also the most notorious, these ancient groups are the most notorious for producing nasty toxins as well. The colder, the types of algae that live in colder waters tend to produce fewer of the toxins.
Fascinating. I'm going to ask you one last question, and then I'll let you go. What's the remedy going forward? What's going to happen? What would you say as a scientist?
Stop the nutrients at their source. I mean, once you've released these nutrients into our waterways and into the natural environment, there is no feasible, logistically or economically, way of trying to stop the blooms or get rid of the nutrients. You've got to stop the nutrients before they're released into our natural environment.
So that means
I get people all the time give me new schemes for killing off the algal blooms or for getting rid of the nutrients, but you work it out, and it's just economically, it just doesn't make sense. Plus, I have lots of ways of killing algae, but the thing is, it'll kill off everything else in your ecosystem as well.
Right. That's what I was thinking. It's like you could substitute one problem for another, by doing that, right?
For example, you can chlorinate your swimming pool, and you can kill off the algae and kill off everything else in your swimming pool, right?
Yeah.
But that's not what we want.
Right.
In a natural environment, we don't want a completely sterile body of water. We still want the fish and all the other things.
Yes, of course. So ultimately, it's on the state to both either produce a better water quality treatment system, right? That's either a state or a federal issue, or to persuade farmers that they need to use fertilizer more sparingly.
Yeah, I mean, this problem with nutrients has been known for a long time, and mm-hmm. there are nutrient regulations both at the state and federal level. And all I guess I would say is clearly the rules we have right now, the laws we have right now are not working and or they're not being enforced.
Yeah, I'd say it was probably a combination of both because I don't know anybody who's going over to every single farm and saying, let me see the number of pounds of fertilizer you just put on your fields this year. Yeah, that ain't happening. Well, Dr. Brand, I can't thank you enough for joining me today. I really appreciate the benefit of your expertise and, really nice explanation for what's actually going on here. I hope we'll speak again in the future. I'm looking forward to it. Thank you, sir. And thank you so much for listening, people. And thanks to my sponsor, Emmy Cheese. And we'll see you next week with another show. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Searching for the